extremely attractive. It does things marvelously. So, and obviously, it's a believer, even though it just believes in elementary scales. I thought to look to see if I could find an interpretation of the implanton in physics as we practice it. What's on my first slide? Well, this is just a review for those who are not terribly familiar with it. The implanton is a scalar field. It's very easy to say what it does. It has one foot in established physics, in that the equation of evolution that you proposed for is a standard of Klein-Gordon equation with a covariantized Dahl inversion. So it certainly has one foot in established physics, but it has a very large foot also in a terra incognita, because you want to use this solution to do the job it's been designed to do, which is that you want to have conditions that a universe which is confined to a small homogeneous region gives rise to an exponential expansion of that homogeneous region called inflation. For that, the scenario that's used is to have this scalar field condense. That is, its average over this homogeneous patch as a field has to be not equal to zero. The homogeneous patch can start out to be extremely small, but it has to be sufficiently homogeneous. It can just be a few Planckian dimensions, but sufficiently homogeneous so that you can define modes, and then you can do usual physics, and you want it to inflate. However, in order to do so, the amplitude, the average phi, has to be Planckian. To inflate to something as large as our world, it has to be as big as 6 Planck masses. So you're dealing with a terra incognita. You need very big amplitudes. That doesn't mean that the energy, by the way, is very big. The energy doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to exceed the bounds, the Planckian bounds, which would require an appeal to quantum gravity, because the energy is a mass squared times phi squared. And the m, fortunately, that you need to fit the fluctuation spectrum that comes out of the Klein-Gordon equation is small, so m is 10 to the minus 6. So if phi is of order 1, you're well within the energy bounds, which does not require quantum gravity. So it's kind of a semi-classical theory, so that's comfortable. However, to explain a number like 10 to the minus 6 obviously is not an easy job, because 10 to the minus 6 is a big mass on elementary particle scales. One TeV is 10 to the minus 13 or something like that. And so it's very, very big on the scale of particle physics. For a while, this was in the late 1970s, I had hoped that this was associated with grand unification, but that turned out to be a flop. So you have to do something else. So one of the things is to explain, we want to explain condensation, we want to explain amplitudes of order 1, we want to explain masses which are big, but less than 1. So it's neither big nor small. That's never very easy. And then there's this peculiar thing that in order to account for present-day fluctuations, both large-scale structure and CMBR fluctuations, you appeal to modes which are created during inflation behind what's called the horizon, behind the Planck, behind the Hubble distance, a characteristic of inflation. And for that, The analysis begins when the frequencies involved are a little less than Planckian, but in the mathematics you're allowed to go as small as possible, and these modes just pour out, and you have to appeal to mode creation. But you also have to appeal to mode creation in the adiabatic expansion. In the adiabatic expansion, you begin with a very dense system, and then it expands, and the wavelengths stretch. So if you began with a cutoff right at the beginning of the Big Bang, these most stretch, but the density of modes we become so small as to be ridiculous. So you suppose that modes have to be made then also. The same problem comes up in a black hole evaporation. When you when a black hole evaporates, the modes which give rise to Hawking radiation, when you take it back, and when you take the mode, and when you make a wave packet of modes which would become a Hawking photon, and when you take it back in time, you get very, very close to the horizon. You get a blue shift if you take it back in time, and you will easily exponentially exceed the Planck mass as you go backwards in time near the horizon, and that's, you don't know what to do. That's called the Trans-Planckian problem. And so forward in time, what it means that coming out somehow near the horizon once more, you must make the modes which are going to give rise to the Hawking radiation. So with this problem of mode creation is a very serious one, and you encounter it in many problems. And of course, Raphael with the dark energy is appealing to fluctuations of energy, which is related to modes coming and going. So that's a very important problem, and I'm still at sea about that, but we'll see what I have to say. My point of view on all of these problems, where in the terra incognita, is that I would say that I'm a radical conservative. I'm kind of situated between David Brooks, is that his name, and Paul Krugman in the New York Times, neither conservative nor liberal, but somewhere in the middle. I take the point of view that physics, when it works, works very, very well. So let's use physics as it works, push it where we know it's not going to work, which is to Planckian scales, push it into failure, to run into inconsistencies, get our fingers burnt, find out as well as we can what the troubles are, what, and make a diagnosis as well as we can. And by the way, failure must be anticipated, because as I mentioned to you, the inflaton phenomenology, which we're trying to explain, calls upon Planckian scales. So we cannot hope to avoid failure. We want to invite failure. Failure also means that we expect that we're going to run into strong Planckian physics, because once we run into Planck-length experimental interactions, it will dominate everything, and we'll have a strong coupling problem. The usual notions of a quantum field theory will not work. It could classify configurations of fields in terms of modes and momentum eigenstates, which scatter. And must break down the perturbative point of view, and we're at the Planckian scale. So we have to find out what to do. Once we make diagnoses, then we have to fashion what I call reasonable hypotheses. Now, you can say reasonable hypotheses, that's a very subjective word, reasonable. I define a reasonable hypothesis as something which is intelligible. And I was thinking, how can I define this? I put myself in Faraday's shoes in the earlier part of, I guess, in the first half of the 19th century, and he had space, and he postulated that he could account for his experiments in a very beautiful way, and by lines of force going through space, a perfectly crazy idea, empty space and lines of force. He imagined rubber bands extended through space with attention. That's a reasonable hypothesis. Why is it reasonable? Because rubber bands are something tangible, something he had experience with. So we call upon the physics that we understand, see if we can frame our new hypotheses in terms of what we do understand to make it get some feeling, get some intelligibility. Not because we believe in it, not because Faraday believed in rubber bands. But rubber bands led to Maxwell and led to everything that we know. It's because when you do this, you invite a further progress to make a theory. So to step to a theory. A reasonable hypothesis is something which is intelligible, which you must regard as a step to a theory. So that's the point of view. So I'm not going to satisfy you. I'm going to leave you very hungry. Well, when you're confronted with such of these problems, it doesn't do any harm to go back to the ancestors, to the beginning of the historical thought anyway. So I thought it good to quote the Hebrew text, Genesis 1, and see what's good about it and what's not so good about it. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. There was no light. There was no form. There was no light. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. So Genesis 1 has two propositions. It has that the universe, as our universe, arose from a system without form and darkness, empty. Void was the 17th century word for empty. No light, no photons. So one proposition is that a vacuum and nothing is formless, is chaos. And that proposition has lasted for thousands of years, and people still hang on to this as a fundamental hypothesis. I was very happy to read last night in Scientific American an article, and I forgot the name of the man at Penn State, an astrophysicist group, Martin. That the loop quantum of gravity in the bounce, it gives you an initial condition which is going to bounce back, which is chaotic. So maybe chaos is more than just a hypothesis. Maybe it has a theoretical backing, but that we don't know for sure. Anyway, that's been a going hypothesis for a few thousand years. And then I read a little bit about how the Babylonians and the Sumerians thought about it in texts which date back to 2000 BC. And unlike the second proposition in the Bible, they're not so hot on the Big Bang. The Bible was all on the Big Bang. Let there be light. On a space-like surface, there was light. The Babylonians and the Sumerians were much more the slow emergence from chaos into islands which had form and from them to the universe as we know it. And look, at Soma Krausa looked at these fellows then, and to the Hebrews. I think that the Hebrews, you see, I was wondering why. They lived in a stark desert. They were a pastoral group. They really had a hard time living, and they were confronted with the dryness and light, so it was natural for them to postulate, more natural, I would say, that they liked the Big Bang, and suddenly there was light, that's where they lived. And then the Babylonians and Sumerians will have to struggle with floods and earth forming all over and stuff. Inform stuff. So probably, and by the way, if you read the Egyptians, their universe is very narrow. But you know that, the Nile. Their universe is highly bounded, and it runs up and down.
A string theory. It's like
string theory. Yeah, but strings are supposed to. Now, the authors of Inflation, and as far as I know, the first guys. And were we who did it in the late 70s, was growth from the seed out of chaos. And we being children of Einstein, we wanted the universe to be caused. And we wrote a paper called The Causal Universe, in which it grew out of a seed. There was an exponential period. The pre-universe we imagined to be chaos. And I still remember when I gave a talk in Vienna in 1978, that Sechsel said, he shrugged his shoulders, well, you have to begin from somewhere. And I read the same sentence when I read up on the Babylonians and Sumerians, one of the guys said, look, it's a natural thing, you have to begin from somewhere. So it is rather natural. And Inflation then was our response to begin with chaos and our response for our need to have a causal, a homogeneous state, like a causally caused a distribution of matter on a space like surface, which was homogeneous, was sufficiently homogeneous that it could be like our universe. And so we invented this, and then Aaron Cash and Francois Anglais, which is some nice things. They showed that it was flat. And Peter Starobinsky in Russia had the same idea, had the causality and the flatness. And then came this very beautiful work a few years after that, by using the scalar field phi, the Ilpaton, to implement this inflation idea. And the way we did it was a self-consistent process. It was not. It could have worked if we just didn't hang on to it. We weren't sufficiently ambitious. Namely, we said there was no curvature, then there was curvature. If you had curvature, then you had a non-trivial energy momentum tensor. If you had a non-trivial energy momentum tensor, you made more curvature. And you could build up an exponential expansion that way. And that's how we did it. But when the Inflaton scenario came out with Linda and Butanov and Steinhoff and these people, things worked so beautifully and they explained so much that seemed to be less contrived than what we did. And then I dropped it, which was a mistake because it really had worked out very well. It's an extremely attractive hypothesis, as I say, natural, but it has these enigma in it. These have these Planckian enigma that must be explained. So let's get on to how I wish to explain it. I'm going to hang on to a fluid analogy, right from the beginning, by the way, when we did it. And I think it was a remark of Gersi in the late 1970s that the city universe had a negative pressure. In any case, we were very much impressed by the negative pressure at that time. And I want to speak to you about, because I'm going to work on fluid analogies. In a fluid, the energy momentum tensor is as written. And in a field, the fluid expression is expressed in terms of fields and the derivative of fields by the second expression. So by analogy, if you begin with fields, then you invent a form factor which you identify with something you call the pressure. The usefulness of it is to work by analogy. If it's something called a pressure, then if you know a little bit about what a fluid, perhaps you can think about what's going on. And then it becomes very interesting, because the pressure, in order to have an exponential expansion, is a negative quantity. How can pressure be negative? Well, that's a very interesting question. Usually when we do fluids and thermodynamics, we think about a fluid in a cylinder. When we press on it, the pressure is positive. The volume goes down. dE is minus pdV. And we put energy into it. If it expands, the volume goes up, the pressure is positive, the energy goes down. That's very useful. That was used to make steam engines. And by the way, for those who haven't seen it, there's a beautiful article in the Encyclopedia Britannica on a Carnot, written by an Englishman, who says that Carnot's treatise is so good that he can't do better. And he just took Carnot's treatise and he just translated from French into English. So we think we know about fluid dynamics and thermodynamics. In cosmology, when it expands, the pressure being negative, the energy doesn't go down, the energy goes up. So obviously, this picture is inadequate, it's wrong. We have to make another picture. For me, it implies that if the pressure, if the energy is going up, and that something inside the fluid is pushing the fluid out as it expands. So there are little pistons, there are little engines, these little X's, which are pushing the fluid out. And these little pumps are homogeneously distributed. Because if they're homogeneously distributed when I push out, then I have more and more of them, so more and more pumps. So therefore, if the pressure is negative with this picture of pumps pushing out to make negative pressure, but to deliver energy to the system, I'm going to have an exponential expansion, because the more I make the volume, and the more I make the pumps, the more I make the pumps, the more energy I put in, the more energy I put in, the more expands. So there's a very tight relation between the exponentiation of the expanding volume and the negativity of the pressure. Therefore, we're incited by these analogies to look for fineness, the inflatonness, as a field which describes a density of energy-giving machines within the system. So we have a system, we have the vacuum of modes. And in addition to the vacuum of modes, there's another system, which are energy-given engines, which are distributed homogeneously within the system. So let's look for fineness and inflatonness as a fluid, as a field, which replaces the fluid of energy-giving machines. Now, what models are available in physics if we hold on to this picture? Well, really the only model we have in physics is quantum field theory. So let's begin with quantum field theory and see if we can find it. Since we're interested in Planckian scale, the quantum field theory we'll use is the most simple you can imagine, a massless scalar field, massless because any ordinary mass that we know in physics is very, very small compared to Planck's mass, something about vacuum massless. Then, in usual quantum field theory, you classify field configurations by the modes of the field. This field, little phi, is not the inflaton field, big phi. It's some quantum field. Excuse me. Getting asthma. The modes of a field. And if there are no interactions, the density of modes is at a cutoff, a big lambda, is proportional to the cutoff cubed. And the energy density is proportional to the cutoff to the fourth power. And there's no reason, if you do free field theory, not to let lambda go to infinity. Then you get infinite energies. It doesn't matter because it's subject to nothing. So it's just empty mathematics. And now you've put in the gravity and the mathematics suddenly becomes very troubling and very full and fraught with significance. It's no longer trivial. Even in the simplest model, but take Newtonian gravity, so you have a bit of vacuum here and another bit of vacuum here and field density here and field density there. And then there's attractive interactions between the field stuff here and the field stuff there. In the Newtonian estimate, you get something like lambda 6. So in the Newtonian estimate, the energy density is lambda 4 minus lambda 6. And you expect that if you do things seriously, if you make a perturbative expansion in 1 over n Planck squared and do it relativistically on the dimensional grounds, you're always going to get a lambda 6 over n Planck squared, and so forth. And then you would expect in general that if you go to every order in perturbation theory, if you're not too far from where things go haywire, that you'll have a term proportional to the lambda 4 times a slowly varying function of lambda, and a term in lambda 6 times a slowly a varying factor. And you're going to get something like this. It's pretty hard to avoid the thought that if you do things in perturbation theory in this way, that you're going to avoid some kind of a picture of a rho of lambda of energy density, which is going to go to zero at the Planckian scale, and it rises from the conventional lambda 4, and then it goes to maximum, and it comes back down. So I suppose if you do this in perturbation theory, that's what we get. And one can work very hard to get good answers for one of the higher and higher powers. But I think that's a rather thorough exercise. Because in this region, in any case, you know very well that what you're doing is all wrong. It's all wrong because if you have a homogeneous space by the energy constraint of a general relativity, rho has to be greater than zero because rho is proportional to h squared. I forgot to mention all constants of order one are one. One third is one, pi is one, and so on. And I'm in a flat space. Is there anything else to say? Whatever I need, it's true. Just put that to hold. But the important point is not to hold on to that, but to zero in on how we're going to try to get something which is right. Namely, around this zero, the picture is going to change. The picture that we get from perturbative field theory in the presence of gravity has to change. And as rho lambda tends to negative quantities, there must be other elements which we've missed out on in our perturbative kind of thinking. And the question is how to try to image that, to remember that we want to get an input up. And the reason, of course, why this goes negative is like this minus lambda sixth term. It's due to gravitational attraction of within field configurations. Gravitational attraction, negative gravitational attraction, and energy within the field configurations. And a negative energy density compared to zero means bound states. Therefore, you're invited from this simple consideration to postulate that in addition to modes, when you go into lambda on the scale, on the Planckian scale, which is lambda zero, that in addition to classifying field configurations by their modal content, you are obliged to classify them as well, a postulate one, by the bound state aggregates of fields and vacuum. So that's the first big working up in the traditional way to audacious hypotheses. Namely, when the length scale becomes Planckian, field configurations not only have to be classified in terms of modes, but in terms of bound state aggregates. And how did I start all this in the first place? When Lenny Susskind gave a talk on dark energy, Raphael slipped into my pocket a paper on how you make dark energy production. And that was from corsets. So I immediately imaged that I had material stuff, the field stuff, on his corset sites. And it was the material stuff, which were bound state aggregates on the corset sites. And it was just this material stuff that leaked in or leaked out of these bound state aggregates localized on space-time corset sites. And that's what got me started in the first place, and here I am. And that's, they got this very, very nice result on a statistical analysis. At the dark energy, the dark energy is the order of magnitude of the square of the Hubble constant. It's a very beautiful result. But you have to tell me what you do about power after that. So I'm going to postulate. Now, yeah, I should say one more thing. I don't have a slide on it. There's a series of papers by Venu Pahantani, who does perturbative field theory due to gravity, due to gravitational interaction among modes, and he boosts up the frequency. Either you can do it by hand on a piece of paper, or you can watch what modes do as the universe contracts, going backwards in time, and the wavelength becomes smaller and smaller. And he finds that there's a critical wavelength for which the modes become overdamped. In his mechanism, the overdamping is when the energy gets so high due to the blue shift that they just scatter each other out of creation and nothing is left. They, before they can execute one wavelength's worth of vibration, they get scattered out, and that's all we're acting. So you see immediately, in that perturbative way, the death modes are no good. You can't classify the field configurations as you do, but looked upon that way. So why did I want to get this? That's why. So in Paradani's way to find the breakdown of perturbation theory, it goes through all the damping. And that comes down to what I said about the corset network, or if you don't work covariantly, a foam network. But I like covariantly because of my conservatism. Covariant physics works so beautifully, it's a shame not to hold on to it. So you might as well hold on to covariance. And that's why I prefer the corset network to the perform network on space-like surfaces. And, but in any case, whatever, if the idea of overdamping modes and a discretization of space or space-time go together. Because if you take a phonon in a solid, and once the wavelength becomes smaller than the interparticle distance, a phonon will damp. And you can't squeeze a lattice vibration in at a wavelength which is smaller than the interparticle distance. So the overdamping of Parentani, the downfall of perturbation, perturbative techniques at the Planck scale, all incite one to make a big hypothesis too, that space-time is discretized. Well, a hypothesis three, the Lorentzian variance, because I want to keep things covariant because I like it. But, you know, all of this is subjective. You have to choose what you like and what you don't. But it is, I try to adhere as far as possible to a traditional science. That's where progress has been made in the past, and so I hold on to it. Well, you put it together that there was this negative energy density with bound state aggregates, overdamping and all of that, and the natural thing is to suppose that you have bound state aggregates which are centered about the cross-set sites. Therefore, the Trans-Planckian field, well, I shouldn't call that Trans-Planckian, I would say a Planckian field configurations about in the field configurations, to my mind, I'm now postulating are ephemeral because of space-time, ephemeral bound state aggregates that come up in the action integral. And namely, when you do the complete action integral in space-time with the field, that the action is delivered by bits. And that's a footnote in their paper on dark energy. It should be more than a footnote.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, because you wanted to, because you like e to the is, or you like the I, and yeah. No, it's important. All right, so now I have a physical picture. I'm ready. Oh, I'll be done. I didn't realize I had until 3:30. I just saw that, so I'll be done before time. I'll make you happy. I'm ready to start the seminar because I want to interpret phi and I want to interpret m. Um, we saw that we had perturbative techniques, and there was the notion of modes and interacting modes. For lambda less than some scale, which I call lambda zero, which we expect to be order one. Therefore, this density of modes, nu of lambda, for lambda less than lambda zero, is dictated. It's not just working with a cutoff lambda zero, which is a priori in your field theory as a regulator. It's a real dynamical quantity. And the density of modes, therefore, it has a sense of a real dynamical fluid with a varying density, because this cutoff can vary in space and time. How can it vary in space and time? I take one region, take another region. Because, like I say, I wasn't happy with my seminar this morning, and so I began to write it again. And so my slides are incomplete. I'm leaving out some slides.
But you can write things on the board if you want.
No, it's okay. I can use my hand. You have these Planckian bound state entities, which are harboring field stuff. At the same time, that is the field stuff described on the scale, on the Planckian scale, and maybe a little more than Planckian. At the same time, you have field configurations that can hop from site to site, which have wave number, which can vary on similar scales. So on a scale near Planckian, there are field configurations which don't know on which foot to dance. Sometimes they can be trapped, but only to be re-released, or sometimes they can propagate by bouncing. When they're trapped, I would like to have a tight analogy with the tight binding approximation of the metal, but it's trickier than that. In the tight binding approximation, what you do is you take atoms, which are bound states, in which the electrons are bound states, and then the propagating modes are the due to the overlap of the bound state wave functions from atom to atom. And then you take orthogonal linear combinations of atomic functions, and you get bands. That would be the mechanism of getting bands. But for this stuff, for the fields, I can't do that. I just have to assume that this field stuff, which is going to propagate from site to site on the closest set. But what I do so say is as they propagate from site to site, when their wavelength becomes small enough to be Planckian, that there's going to be a tunneling in and out of the bound state aggregates. And namely, I can have a field configuration of floating around. Here's all the field stuff which is aggregated around the site. And I can get a mode which will tunnel into it and tunnel out of it. It doesn't quite know what a foot to stand on. I remember once, when was it? Either as a graduate student or very early on, I tried to confront the problem of what to do about the hydrogen atom and when it's just barely bound. It's that kind of thing. When the electrons on a hydrogen atom are just barely bound, they're really a niche of an issue. I'm looking at it. And they're neither goats nor sheep nor cabbage. They, They're part of the continuum and they're part of the bound state system. There's a confusion in the terminology because they're not clean. And so here, there's going to be communication between the trans-Planckian, the Planckian bound state description of field stuff and the propagate, or the non-propagate, or whatever, that's what I call a non-propagating sequestered configurations of field stuff. There's going to be that characterization of field stuff, and at the same time, there's going to be propagating modes. And there's communication between the two, a radical communication between the two. And you would anticipate that there's a communication and there would be a matrix element which tells you if it's more modal in character, if it's more Bayes stuff, or if it's more bound state configuration in character, which is Psi stuff. And if I imitate what you do in particle physics, for example, when you have a liquid helium, then the density of things are squares of second quantized wave functions. So I would attempt to invent that kind of thing, imitating what you do in liquid helium. This I just did last night because I wasn't happy what I did before, and so on. You see, this is where I swim, because it's very hard. We're doing physics that we don't know. And so we have to elaborate, as I said, we have to elaborate hypotheses which are reasonable by analogy. And so I'm trying hard to do it, but I don't know if I'm successful. But this is my first shot, essentially where I am in my thinking. I like the idea of the cis and the trans and the different types of configurations and the communication. And this is a shot at the communication. Anyway, it has the advantage because if I have this term in my action, then there's going to be a contribution to the propagator of the cis-Planckian fluid. This is the cis-Planckian fluid, which is the phi, the propagator, and there's going to be a self-energy due to its interaction, namely, there's going to be the cis-Planckian fluid is going to fall into the bound state aggregate and be spat out. And this bubble is representing the cis-Planckian aggregate, the wave function of the cis-Planckian aggregate. And so you're going to have a contribution to this. A propagator, like in field theory. And so the self energy is going to be m squared. So that's I think in my picture of these two kinds of field configurations and the communication between them, it's fairly inevitable that there's going to be a mass parameter, which is a communication between the two, which happens by tunneling. So that's the origin of the mass. Here's the last 20 minutes before I did the seminar that I was unhappy with my thinking before. But I think it could well be that this is what's going on, that you have the cis-Planckian density coming in, it tunnels into the bound state aggregate, it gets spat out, and the 10 to the minus 6th for the value of the matrix element, it's not unreasonable, because, you know, when you do tunneling, exponential minus pi dx often runs you into 2 pi. It so happens e to the minus 4 pi is to the minus 5, e to the minus 2 pi is to the minus 5. So e minus 4 pi is to the minus 5. So it isn't unreasonable. This construction, it reminds me very much of the way a Dirac particle propagates. How does a Dirac particle propagate? If it's massless and you're in a chiral eigenstate, it propagates in a chiral eigenstate. And then there's a matrix element called the mass, M, which gives you the amplitude to switch. There's a chiral plus eigenstate coupled to a chiral minus eigenstate with a matrix element called a mass. And so the chiral plus eigenstate flips to a chiral minus eigenstate. It hovers for a while on the chiral minus eigenstate, and then it comes down, and then it keeps on going. So instead of the chiral, instead of being in the configuration of the chiral minus eigenstate, say it's in the configuration of a bound state aggregate, and it's very analogous. And you see that the mass arises in my picture in a way that's very analogous to the way the mass couples the different chiral states. For my picture, the mass couples the cis propagating configuration to the trans non-propagating configuration. So there's deep analogies. I learned this way, this fruitful way to look at the Dirac equation from Alain Cohn, who considers this this passage, this is an aside, this passage, this propagator. This is a propagator between the two surfaces. He calls this a propagator. And he writes his field theory in terms of ordinary propagators on ordinary space-time surfaces, and this propagator. And he calls that a kind of non-commutative geometry, the non-commutation geometry coming between in this geometric passage here, between two states, between two points. And it's interesting because he gets results from it. So that's one of the motivations that turns me on. The importance for cosmogenesis of this concept of mass is immense. There's a deep philosophical implications. But you see, for ordinary fluids, density fluctuations in water or what have you are massless fluctuations. And when you open a textbook on the fluid dynamics and you run through the mathematics, you find that the masslessness is a translation of legislating the continuity equation into the equation for the acceleration of the fluid under pressure forces. It's a direct consequence, mathematically, from line A to line B, of legislating the equation of continuity into dynamics. It's also common sense. If you have a fluctuation that has a bump, an excess of density here, and the mass of the fluid is conserved, and then if it goes up there, it's got to go down there. In an ordinary fluid, you cannot have a k equals zero excitations. You cannot have a uniform fluctuation. You can't have a density here, and then the whole thing goes up because it's conserved. What comes up here has to come down there. That's reflected in the Fourier transform of the wave equation by the fact that the limit of the frequency of the wavelength goes to infinity is zero. There must be no physical consequences of a k equals zero situation. However, our fluid is not conserved. We have the coupling we have the coupling of our fluid is the Cisplankian fluid. I didn't say this. This is a very important assumption. The only components of field configurations which can affect macroscopic general relativity, such as the Hubble constant in the expansion, such as the mass of a black hole, the back reaction on a classical relativistic space, general relativistic space-time, is due to propagating stuff. You cannot conceive of a field configuration which is locked into a bound state configuration, which is sequestered, which is going to push a space out, or suck the space in. It has to be the response for me, I make a postulate, that macroscopic general relativistic parameters are conditioned, are responding to Cisplankian directly, it's the direct response to to variations of Cisplankian configurations which are responsible for macroscopic parameters of space-time. The Hubble constant is the back reaction due to modes, the change in the mass of Hawking's dmdt is equal to the rate of evaporation. How do you compute the rate of evaporation? The rate of evaporation is computed at infinity, far from the black hole, where by Bugger-Yubov transformation, it's encoded in the energy of the modes which are, in the quanta of the energy of the modes which are evaporated. It's to the, that's what gives you the dmdt. It's very important. That's not to say that the Transplankian stuff where the modes got made is irrelevant. It's a two-step process. You recondition your field configurations at the Planckian scale. You see what happens then to the propagating sector, to the Cisplankian sector, and then you get the response. When we write h squared is equal to rho, that rho is due to the Cisplankian sector. That's one of my essential hypotheses. Perhaps, you know, well, I made many essential hypotheses. I haven't made a list. But they seem to me to be all common sense-like. So if we want to make a universe, well, God knows that's macroscopic, we better get the energy into the Cisplankian sector. So we want to make a homogeneous patch, which has a bump due to a homogeneous sector of field fluctuations due to the interaction with the pumps, with the Transplankian pumps psi squared. This can make a pair, and so you can build up an energy bump. In other words, because of the non-conservation of my acoustic mode of my Cisplankian fluid, I have a Cisplankian fluid which is described by density mu of lambda. It's a non-conserved liquid in interaction with sources. It distributed all over, which play the role of my homogeneously distributed engines, which I called upon to illustrate what negative pressure meant. All of that goes into the non-conservation as encoded in this psi squared term. I make a pair from this, the average of the Transplankian density, and so I can transfer energy from the Transplankian system to the Transplankian system. And so I can begin with chaos. Here's the biblical chaos, which is not expanding. And then there'll be a fluctuation due to this term, which builds up this thing. And that's my seed. And that's my cosmogenetic seed. So the secret to cosmogenesis is in the mass. It is in the mass of the inflaton in this view. And I think that the secret of Hawking radiation also. Hawking radiation is built up from configurations near the horizon. And God knows, I wish I could figure out the entropy balance, why it works, why the M has to go in. But I imagine on the average that you make entropy when in the Hawking radiation problem that way also. Anyway, and then non-conservation gives you this. By the same token, as you can make a universe, you can make the fluctuations and the fluctuations that have to be created from behind the Hubble radius during inflation in order to get the scale invariant and the fluctuation spectrum. I won't discuss the details of that. It's very, very clearly explained in Vulcano's book extensively, and one can learn it. More clear you cannot be. But that's the same thing that's going on. And Vulcano has the explicit sentence in his treatment that he need only begin with the frequency when the frequency is Planckian, and he just doesn't pay attention to what happened before. But what happened before is, I presume, the same kind of mechanism as what I'm discussing here. You just create modes in a tiny region. So, where am I? I think I said what I wanted to say. Here's the resume. I'm beginning with a system for which I take to be chaotic, non-expanding, and I think of it as a cis-trans equilibrium in which the energy density is zero, it's not expanding, and so the density of cis-Planckian modes has to correspond to that value of the energy to make the system a quasi-equilibrium and non-expanding. So I begin with that system. Now, as I said, I read this Scientific American article, and it seems that when you take a loop quantum gravity and you put a look at a bounce, that you go to that kind of thing that can serve as an initial state. I don't know if anybody has seen that work on the reduction of a loop quantum gravity calculation, which takes the universe back to a bounce, and it goes into chaos. Look at that calculation must be read. Obviously, Scientific American is not the place to read. Then there is a trans Planckian reservoir. This is the pumps, which I abbreviated by psi squared, which is 50 less than zero. A cosmogenesis develops, as I say, it expands to a certain point. And then you have to read some magic in Linda to say when it's going to stop, when it's going to not, when you're going to get conditions which are going to regress the fluctuation. And that's a big flaw here. We don't know how far this fluctuation will develop, how big the universe will be, and then after that it will regress back with the Gordon equation, which comes out of all of this, that I forgot to say, that the phi field propagates both by hopping and by in and out of the transplanking things to give the mass. And you put the two together and you get the Bell inversion due to the hopping plus the mass term, which is the in and out motion. So that's the mechanism by which the exponential expansion stops after a while, and then you get regression of the fluctuation back. But there's nothing in here which will tell us how far it will go. And there one has to concentrate and read very hard the considerations of Linda and maybe get some inspiration from there. I don't know anything about that. I don't know if anybody does. And then of course, as it comes back as the Hubble constant goes away, and the average value of phi comes down to something of order one, and then the kinetic energy of the phi field competes with the potential energy and the expectation value of phi, the m squared phi squared. Then, when that happens, everything goes berserk. If you look at the solution of a nonlinear Klein-Gordon equation, it spirals, but that certainly is a very poor effective theory at that time. Then probably what happens, and then what happens is what people call reheating, which is, I think, a very bad term. I expect that what happens is the conversion of something which is very systematic and quasi-linear, like a laminar flow, it gets converted to turbulent flow. And that the Reynolds number of this problem is when phi is of order one. And then you break up the systematic exponential expansion and this collective field phi. Remember, phi is a collective field that represents all modes of all fields. And this collective description of evolution breaks up because the phi dot squared breaks it up. And then probably reheating is a turbulent effect until it comes down. Remember that turbulence is, you begin with a macroscopic description of a fluid flow. You go to smaller and smaller eddies. The energy leaks down until it becomes microscopic in size. And then it gets turned into heat. That's how laminar flow gets converted into heat. And I imagine here one has to work this out. So I've left behind many eddies with more work in the future than almost a zero amount of work which has been done in the past.
Okay, thank you very much. So any questions for Robert? So
yes, you wrote down a coupling term, phi squared.
Phi squared.
And presumably you didn't write it down, but there's a kinetic term for phi,
yeah,
which is the hopping.
Phi.
But if you were to make some effective field theory, would there be no kinetic term for psi because it's sequestered?
I made no kinetic term for
and
psi.
So, if so, how would you write an effective field theory for it, or would you not write it?
I just said I'm going to say that there's an expectation value of psi squared. It's a phi is like a quantum field in interaction with a rather classical lump.
So you haven't assigned the dynamics to psi.
No, I had until last night.
Oh, I see.
And then I reread what I had done. I didn't like it. I said I didn't want to say that. And then I did this. I like the idea of just saying that psi squared is a lump. and it doesn't propagate, so it's a bound state wave function. And one of the things I would like to do clearly is to make this explicit, to develop this idea much more. I thought I had it much better when I asked to arrange for the seminar, but then I read what I wrote and I don't like it.
More questions?
But what you say is that there's certainly is the other part. There is an effective action. There's a phi of x plus delta. In other words, I imagine that you have succeeded in building a field theory on your process by hopping because you built a down version. So I imagine that done. Is it?
Well, partly. I mean, Steve Johnson, maybe someone else will know. Steve Johnson has worked out the case of a massive and also a massless scalar field.
Yeah. If I can get hold of that and copy that and see how we can put it in.
Is that posted to the archive?
And that would be, that would be my unperturbed propagator, and then I would perturb it with a psi squared phi squared. So it seems to be pretty much that way, and that I can join the cross-set idea, and I want very much to join in the dark energy idea. And there are many things to be put together.
If you want to preserve singularity for the subplanking models.
A unitarity.
That's right. So it seems it makes more sense to go give psi a dynamics just say frozen. Or otherwise, I mean, it seems a say information. Maybe
I'm thinking about
the subplanking modes to the superplanking modes, and that is something that we don't want to see. I mean, that is a counter to the common sense.
I don't know how to think about unitarity I would have to. I write the whole thing down in terms of states. I'm looking at configurations, and I say that these, in a sense, I do have unitarity in configuration space. I say that this fluctuation of phi is born of something that comes out of psi. So I can say that in some sense, I can imagine I should be able to, by the conservation equation, that field stuff is conserved.
Sure, I mean,
but it's not the conventional way to think about states. We don't think about states in terms of numbers of modes or field configurations. Remember, this is not production of quanta. This is, as far as phi is concerned, I'm changing my Hilbert space all the time because I admit a space which is a Hilbert space which is dynamically changing. So how do you think about unitarity?
That there should be some
decoupling. It's a unitarity here is a tricky concept. A state which is a function of mode content.
Okay, well, there are no more questions, then let's thank Robert again.